flush and we feel pinched. But the big picture, the overarching economic reality of our time, is that the past 60 or 70 years have been the longest sustained period of economic growth and the most extensive and widespread experience of affluence in human history. Yet we seem not one whit closer to realizing the ancient dream of social justice and compassion. We are richer than ever, but the gap between rich and poor has grown wider than ever at the same time. During this time of unprecedented economic expansion, both poverty and homelessness have increased exponentially. Wealth has not trickled down. Those on the lowest economic levels have not been lifted up by the flood tides of economic growth. The other day I was walking across a park on my way to work when a man my age came out of the bushes right in my path. We frightened each other. He recoiled from me. I realized he was afraid to be discovered. Why was he so afraid of this? Maybe it was because the city was in the middle of one of its periodic campaigns to round up the homeless and get them off the streets. But as we continued recoiling from each other in a strange kind of dance, he taking two steps back from me, me taking two steps back from him, I felt something deeper in his fear. I felt it was the nature of his state. He represented a part of us that doesn't want to be discovered. He represented a part of me that I didn't want to see. The dirty part, the uncontrollable part, the part that might fall into the black hole of failure at any moment, the part that might go belly up and die. He was a perfect picture of everything in life that frightened me to death, of everything I couldn't control, of all my own internal monsters, death, failure, uncleanliness, and all the uncontrollable impulses, anger, lust, jealousy, and greed, these demons unleashed. No wonder I didn't want to look at him. No wonder I felt a wave of relief pass over me as he disappeared back into the bushes. But as soon as this wave passed, I felt something else as well. I felt how much fear there was in my reluctance to see this man. Precisely because we have such a strong sense of our own brokenness deep down, whatever happiness we experience carries a subtle undercurrent of fear. When things are going well, when we are experiencing pleasure and are getting what we want, we feel obliged to defend our happiness because it seems so fragile, so unstable. So it is, Sharon Salzberg reminds us, that we deny the very possibility of suffering. We cut ourselves off from facing it in ourselves and in others because we intuit our brokenness, and we fear that if we admit any kind of suffering, it will undermine or destroy our good fortune. So in order to hold on to our pleasure, we refuse to recognize the humanity of a homeless person on the street. We block out the suffering of others. We cut ourselves off from the world's suffering because we fear it will undermine or destroy our own happiness. But if there are homeless on our streets, we can't be happy. They accuse us. They threaten us. Even if we manage to get them out of our parks and off the downtown streets, how can we enjoy what we have if there are people begging for food and for work on the parkway dividers and in the doorways of our churches and synagogues? The only way we can keep them from spoiling our happiness is to try to pretend that they don't exist. But whenever we try to pretend something doesn't exist, our world is reduced, and we become unhappy. Happiness is precisely our experience of the fullness of the world. I saw a film once that conveyed this sense of fullness and connection quite vividly. It was a television film about human conception made by Scandinavian scientists with microscopic cameras. At the beginning of the film, we see thousands of sperm cells pouring into the female reproductive system like the Allies storming the Normandy coast. Each cell is supremely confident of his mission in life. Each one is convinced he will triumph in the end. Then one by one, they flame out and die. They crash into the fallopian walls and perish, or they simply run out of steam and begin to disintegrate. And if, right after crashing into the wall or running out of steam, one of these fallen cells were interviewed by Howard Cosell and asked what the meaning of it all might be, He would probably say, "There is no meaning to it. The whole thing is a meaningless crapshoot. You think you're going to produce a life, but then you just crash into a wall and die for no reason." From the limited point of view of each individual cell, there is in fact no meaning to the life they have lived. Their lives seem to have been wasted and absurd. But as this magnificent film unfolds, we see that they are part of a larger process, the propagation of life itself. One single cell, against astronomical odds, penetrates the skin of the egg, and then the egg starts to revolve and send out filaments of tissue all around its circumference so that it looks like a great sun, a great radiant light turning and turning in its firmament. And out of this dazzling cosmic dance comes life itself. I felt this same sense of fullness, of being connected to a larger source of meaning and purpose, on the floor of a redwood forest once. It was toward the end of a long hike in Mendocino County, and I had just dropped down to the ground to rest in the middle of a redwood grove. There was a small branch sticking out of the ground in front of me. I reached out to pull myself up with it, but it gave way in my hand. The bottom of the living branch had already become part of the thick, rich loam that lay beneath the forest floor. I lay back and looked up through the branches crowding around me, up to the dazzling gold light at the top of the trees. Everything was reaching for the sun. Every tree, every limb, every shrub. Everything was aspiring upward toward the light and would continue to do so until it died and fell back to the forest floor. Then, divine intelligence embodied in a seed cone would begin to push all this dead matter upward again in the form of new life. The forest was a single, purposeful organism, and every one of its cells, living and dead, was part of this exquisite reach for the light. We can't control sickness, old age, or death. We are terrified of them. But as Sharon Salzberg asks, what would we fear if we experienced ourselves to be part of the whole of nature, moving and changing, being born and dying? What would we fear if we understood that our bodies were joined with the planet in a continual rhythmic exchange of matter and energy? We do not live as isolated fragments, completely separate, but rather as parts of a great dynamic, mutable whole. Every moment we are dying and being reborn, we and all of life. As individuals, we live and die, often without apparent meaning. As a whole people, we are always moving toward the light. And this sense of wholeness is precisely the healing we need, the tikkun, the repair we need to offset our sense of brokenness. Yom Kippur is a day of healing, a day of repair, a day that recognizes our fundamental brokenness and provides us with a remedy. At-one-ment, kaparah. Kaper means to cover. We are covered over by a consciousness of God which blurs the imaginary distinctions we have made between ourselves and others. We are not the first culture in the world to intuit a sense of brokenness in human existence, nor are we the first people to celebrate a yearly ritual of atonement and judgment. In ancient Greece, they had a ceremony called the pharmakos. In the city of Athens, a man and woman, representing all the men and women in the city, were driven away and never permitted back in the city again. This was done to propitiate the gods for the brokenness of all the citizens of Athens. This ceremony supplanted human sacrifice and was a step toward enlightenment. Christianity and Judaism took the process one step further. Christianity sacrificed one human being, one man who died for everyone else's brokenness for all time. No further propitiations would ever be necessary. We Jews went even further. We replaced people altogether with a goat. We read about the sacrifice of the scapegoat in the Torah on the morning of Yom Kippur. But in case we ever imagine we have really risen above our pagan impulses, all we have to do is ask ourselves, who are we trying to run out of town at the moment? Who is our pharmakos? Whom are we asking to propitiate for our own sense of brokenness? The list of candidates is usually quite long. I have spoken of our reluctance to acknowledge the homeless on our streets because of the fear of our own vulnerability they provoke. This is why nearly every homeless initiative that has ever been launched in American cities has been mostly concerned with getting the homeless out of sight. And we would like to keep the hungry, the mentally ill, and the addicted of the world out of sight as well, or at least beyond our borders. They are a pointed reminder of our greed, of our addiction to consuming, of our squandering the world's resources on meaningless consumer luxuries, while elsewhere in the world people starve and die. We would rather hide the victims of this behavior behind gates and fences than face it in ourselves. And we would rather demonize homosexuals than admit to our own very complicated sexuality. Freud was right. We all have every conceivable sexual tendency within us. But since society has placed such a negative charge on certain sexual impulses, we experience them as a darkness, a brokenness, and we feverishly try to obscure them. We try to project them out onto gays and lesbians, and then to demean them, to treat them as somehow deficient. This ongoing inner process takes on a thousand forms. Out of fear, we project our inner darkness onto others. We make demons out of them and then cast them away. Out of fear, we turn away from our own sacred center. And this has never worked. Not once. And it never will. And the reason is this. All human beings are bearers of the divine. And when we try to drive a particular group of people away, we drive God away with them. We sever ourselves from the God who has assured us 100 times that he, she hears the cries of the oppressed and goes where they go. Propitiation of the gods, human sacrifice, this is not the way of Yom Kippur. The way of Yom Kippur is to accept our imperfection. This is what Yom Kippur is all about. We accept that to be human is to be imperfect, to be broken, and we realize that we don't have to project our brokenness onto someone else. We don't have to try to cast it out. We can fix it. We can repair it in the context of our own lives. The way of Yom Kippur is to realize, like Isaiah, that we are all part of a whole, and that we move toward the light of God when we behave this way, when we care for each other, when we realize in our flesh and bones that our own happiness depends on the happiness of everyone else in the world. We can't enjoy our affluence while people are starving. When we experience this sense of the world, we realize that every need in the world is our need. Nature always takes care of the next need. The forest replenishes itself. The T cells in our body strive to heal. The world is set up to heal itself. Our choice is to align ourselves with this healing or not. Compassion heals. Loving kindness heals. Justice heals. Meditation heals. Prayer heals. The Sabbath heals. Yom Kippur heals. All these activities reinforce each other, depend upon each other, and taken together they purify us of our delusion of separation and its attending sense of absurdity. They impart a sense of the sacred to us, an immediate sense of our connection to everyone and to everything, and the imperative for engagement with the world which flows out of this sense. So purified, we simply take care of whatever is in front of our face. We simply answer the immediate need. It is our need. When we are hungry, we eat, and when we are tired, we sleep. When someone else is hungry, we feed them. When someone else is homeless, we find shelter for them. If we try to ignore them, we only darken our own world. Better to pick up the broken shards of our vessel and begin to piece them together again. We are all broken vessels yearning for the light. Chapter 10. The gates clang shut. Ne'ilah. Twice a year, during the days of the Great Temple, on Tisha B'Av and on Yom Kippur, There was a service at the end of the day called Ne'ilah, or closing, because it was performed as the temple gates were clanging shut. We still perform this service on Yom Kippur, and we still call it Ne'ilah, only now it is not the closing of the temple gates that we are referring to, but rather the closing of the gates of heaven. This is generally a very well-attended service. At my synagogue, people throng to the Ne'ilah service. Most of them have been in synagogue all day long, since far more people come to our Yom Kippur services than we can accommodate in a single sanctuary sitting. We have many services going on at once all day long. We have staggered services, alternative services, parallel services out in the social hall, several seatings in the main sanctuary. But by the afternoon service, all the people begin to trickle into the main sanctuary at once. The seats fill up quickly. Then people start sitting on the floor in the aisles. People stand at the back of the room. People sit on the steps up in the balcony and pack themselves into the foyer just outside the sanctuary. As Ne'ilah begins, I look out over a sea of faces tightly pressed together. The sanctuary is filled to more than double its capacity. I always feel a thrill of fear at this moment. Our synagogue is very old, and the main sanctuary is up on the second floor. What if the floor should collapse from the weight of all this overload? What if an earthquake were suddenly to hit? What makes these thousands of people so desperately want to crowd into a space meant to hold only a fraction of that number? The Hasidic master Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev said that it isn't just that the gates of heaven are open during the 10 days of Teshuvah. What is far more significant is that an energy, an attractive force, passes through this opening during these days. This is a very subtle energy, and for most of the 10 days when the gates are wide open, we don't even notice it. But during the Ne'ilah service, as the gates begin to close and the opening becomes narrower and narrower, this attractive energy becomes more and more intense, more and more noticeable. It is precisely this energy which draws us to the Ne'ilah service so intensely, and which inspires us to pray so fervently once there. The prayer we utter at Ne'ilah is that most urgent of all human prayers, the prayer of the last chance. The gates of heaven are closing. We only have a few minutes left. Looking out at the vast throng assembled before me for the Ne'ilah service, I see a purity in these faces I never see at any other time, an innocent suspension of disbelief, a wholehearted yearning one ordinarily only sees in children. This same Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was famous for his chutzpah, his audacity. It was he who once put God on trial for failing to prevent the persecution and economic deprivation of the Jews of his day. Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev convicted God at this trial. He found God guilty of all charges. One year at Ne'ilah, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev declared war on God, but only as a last resort. I heard this story from Rabbi Abraham Karp of Boston. Levi Yitzchak mounted the pulpit to begin the Ne'ilah service in fear and trembling. He was absolutely determined that before the gates of heaven closed, he would wrest a promise from God to give his people a year of blessing and happiness instead of the terrible suffering they had been enduring in recent years. So he did three things. First, he tried supplication. He pleaded with God. He said, "Look, God. An ordinary person who drops a treasure on the floor will stoop down and pick it up without even thinking about it. But you, dear God, you have called us your treasure, and yet you let us fall from your hands to the earth, and you don't pick us up. For 2,000 years you have let us grovel in the dust of exile, and you haven't bent down to pick us up. Is it too much to ask you to act like an ordinary person acts?" Levi saw his words rise up toward heaven in visible waves, and the gates of heaven stopped closing and actually began to open, but just a little bit. So Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev decided to throw all his energy into the vidui, the formal prayer of confession that is a standard feature of all Yom Kippur services, including Ne'ilah. If pleading opened the gates of heaven a little bit, he thought, perhaps repentance would open them up the rest of the way. So, when it came time to recite the confessional, he began to weep, and he cried out, "Woe to us! We live in a crazy world. It used to be that people told the truth on the streets and lied when they came to synagogue. Since they conducted their business in honesty and truth, when they came to synagogue and recited the Vidui on Yom Kippur and they said, 'We have sinned,' they were lying. But now the opposite is the case. They lie on the streets and they tell the truth in the synagogue. They cheat and steal in their ordinary lives, and when they come to synagogue and confess that they have sinned, they are telling the truth." A bitter cry of remorse and repentance could be heard throughout the synagogue as he concluded his Vidui. Levi Yitzchak saw the cry rising toward heaven, and it opened the gates of heaven a little bit wider, but not very far. So Levi Yitzchak declared war on God. That was the only course left to him. Now, a tzaddik, a righteous saint, like Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, doesn't wage war the way a king or a general would wage war, and he doesn't use the same weapons either. A tzaddik employs an army of the righteous, and their weapons are their good deeds. So, in his last desperate attempt to open the gates of heaven wide, Levi Yitzchak raised his head and cried out to the heavens. "Let them speak, not me," Levi Yitzchak boomed. "Remember the 2 rubles the widow Sarah paid her son's teacher instead of spending them on the dress she had longed for. Remember the bowl of soup the yeshiva student shared with his classmates in spite of the fact that he was starving himself. Remember the bundle of money and the parcel of land Reb Chaim lost because he refused to go back on his word." And so Levi Yitzchak went on and on, listing one by one the simple acts of loving-kindness, unselfishness, and mercy the ordinary men and women of his congregation had performed in the past year. As the congregation raised their eyes, they could see the gates of heaven open completely, and they saw their prayers become a garland and rest on God's head as the Holy One descended from the seat of judgment and mounted the seat of mercy. He formed all their hearts as one heart, and he perceives all their actions as one act, the psalmist insists. When I see this great trembling multitude sitting before me at Ne'ilah, I feel as if I am in the presence of a single trembling heart. All the thousands of gestures, the blowing of a nose, the stifling of a yawn, the wiping away of a tear, a person standing up over there and one sitting down over there, a child jumping up, another child crying, all these gestures become one single gesture unfolding across the sanctuary in waves and billows. And I look down at the thousands of faces washed over by an innocence so immense that it covers over everyone, and everyone becomes one suffering, innocent heart. Each face, I now see, has been formed by the same suffering, a suffering that has sunken its cheeks and lined its brow and hooded its eyes. Every face, I now see, is like this. The suffering is visible, like the lines of force on a geological formation, like Levi Yitzchak's supplication and the confession of his congregants, and like the garland of all their prayers taken together which came to rest on God's head. And then there comes a point at which I just don't think I can bear to see this anymore, when the weight of the suffering in all these faces just becomes too heartbreaking for me, and I feel as if I have to scream or run away or cry. And just at that moment, just when I think I can't bear to see this one second more, I see a great light beneath the suffering in all these faces. I suddenly come to realize that what I am seeing only looks like suffering, but really all of it, the sunken skin, the lined brow, the clouded eyes, is just the convulsions and the lines of force a great love makes as it struggles to come to the surface of our lives. And I always feel then that I am standing at the head of an army of infinite power. I look from face to face. So many of them have come to share their burdens with me during the year, and I can see into so many of their hearts. I know that this one has lost a husband, and this one has lost a son, and this one has lost a father, and this one envies all of them because she has never had anyone, but has lived alone, longing for a family all her life. And this one has a husband, but has never been able to have a child, and this one has lost his job. And this one has a job, but it isn't much of one, and he hates it. He hates to get up in the morning, and everyone has always felt him to be a failure. And this one is a big success, but his wife is leaving him, and his children are devastated. And this one has been devastated by her children who seem to have gone bad for no reason she can fathom. Certainly, it couldn't have been for lack of love. Nevertheless, they have fallen into a hell world of lawlessness and drugs, and she can't get them out. And this one has a child whose mind suddenly stopped working. It isn't an emotional problem. The electrons in her brain just aren't firing properly anymore, and every day she becomes more confused, and her mother watches helplessly as she sinks into madness. And this one has been fighting a terrible cancer. It went into remission a few years ago, but now it is back with a vengeance, and she knows she will die soon. And I look from face to face, and I know that all of these people just go on living day to day as if nothing has happened. Quietly, heroically, complaining a little but not nearly as much as they deserve to. They continue to hope, they continue to love, they keep going to work, taking their kids to school, coming to synagogue, and I say to myself, I would go into battle with this army any day of the week. So every year at Ne'ilah, I declare war on God. I turn the full force of our spiritual armamentarium on God, and I say, give us one more year or else. Give us one more year of life, one more year of sun and rain and wind, one more year to labor and to love on this roiling green and blue ball. Give me one more year to love my wife, one more year to watch my children grow. Promise me this or else. Promise me this while there is still a small, charged opening between heaven and earth. Give me one more year of life. Promise me this before the gates come clanging shut. Epilogue. The stars are shining on my head. Sukkot. The stars are shining on the top of my head. The wind is in my hair. A few drops of rain are falling into my soup, but the soup is still warm. I am sitting in a sukkah, a booth with branches draped across the top, which I have erected in my backyard. A deep joy is seeping out from the core of my being and filling me body and soul. It began as a kind of lightness. I felt it as soon as the shofar was sounded to signal the end of Yom Kippur. There were three stars in the sky then. I felt all the weight, all the heaviness of the day, all the death and the judgment and the yearning, all the soulful thrashing and beating of breasts, falling away all at once, suddenly gone. I felt light and clean. The next day, I went into my yard with a hammer and started to build my sukkah. Now I am drinking soup in my sukkah, a booth not quite surrounded by walls, with a roof that must admit starlight, and a deep joy is welling up inside me, a curious, naked joy. During the days of awe, I was stripped of everything, all my hope, all the illusions to which I had been clinging. Now I feel clean and light and full of joy. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days, the Torah enjoins us, so that you will know with every fiber of your being that your ancestors dwelt in booths during their sojourn in the wilderness when they were leaving Egypt. This is a commandment we fulfill not with a gesture or a word, but with our entire body. We sit in the sukkah with our entire body. Only our entire body is capable of knowing what it felt like to leave the burden of Egyptian oppression behind, to let go of it. Egypt, in Hebrew, is Mitzrayim. The root of this word is tsar, a narrowness. Egypt was the narrow place. Only the entire body can know what it felt like to be pushed from a place of dire constriction and into a wilderness, a spacious open world. Only the body can know what it felt like to be born. Only the body can know the fullness of joy. And this is a commandment that can only be fulfilled with joy. All the holidays and all their rituals are to be observed with joy, but there is a special joy, an extra measure of joy, connected to Sukkot. The Torah mentions this requirement 3 times in connection to Sukkot. Perhaps this is because Sukkot is the holiday of the fall harvest. While we rejoice at Passover, it is not a full joy because the spring seedlings are just beginning to come up, just beginning to break the plane of the earth, just beginning to show themselves in the world, and we don't know if they will make it to harvest or not. We rejoice at Shavuot, but it is only the early harvest, the time of the first fruits, and although there is a special joy in this, there is also anxiety. The full harvest won't be until fall, until Sukkot. But at Sukkot there is no anxiety. There is nothing to hold back. There is only rejoicing. The full harvest has come. Or perhaps this special joy we feel at Sukkot is a cathartic joy, a joy in direct proportion to the anxiety of the high holidays. The high priest has gone into the Holy of Holies, emerged alive, and pronounced the unpronounceable name of God. We will live another year. The rains will come. The crops will grow. We will live. Or perhaps this special joy is precisely the joy of being stripped naked, the joy of being flush with life, the joy of having nothing between our skin and the wind and the starlight, nothing between us and the world. We have spent the past many weeks stripping ourselves naked, acknowledging our brokenness, allowing ourselves to see what we won't usually look at, embracing the emptiness at the core of our experience, reducing our lives to a series of impulses that rise up and then fall away again. And we have even let the reins of denial slip a little. We have relaxed our fierce determination to ward off death at any cost. We have invited ourselves to entertain the possibility that we might die. On Rosh Hashanah it is written, we acknowledge, who will live and who will die. And by Yom Kippur, we have acknowledged that it may very well be us who dies. So now we sit flush with the world in a house that calls attention to the fact that it gives us no shelter. It is not really a house. It is the interrupted idea of a house, a parody of a house. According to Jewish law, this booth we must dwell in for 7 days need only have closed walls on 2.5 sides, and we must be able to see the stars through the organic material, the leaves and branches, that constitutes its roof. This is not a house. It is the bare outline of a house. It is like that architectural feature called the broken pediment, the notch in the roof line of the facade of a house, which leaves the mind to complete the line, and thus implants the idea of a line in the mind even more forcefully than an unbroken line would. So it is that the sukkah, with its broken lines, its open roof, its walls that don't quite surround us, calls the idea of the house to mind more forcefully than a house itself might do. And it exposes the idea of a house as an illusion. The idea of a house is that it gives us security, shelter, haven from the storm, but no house can really offer us this. No building of wood and stone can ever afford us protection from the disorder that is always lurking all around us. No shell we put between us and the world can ever really keep us secure from it, and we know this. We never really believed in this illusion. That's why we never felt truly secure in it. The rabbis of the Talmud told a parable. It is the usual way of human beings to feel secure and unafraid while under the shelter of their own roofs. On emerging from their homes, their sense of security is diminished and they begin to feel fear. Israel, however, is different. While in their homes the whole year, they are apprehensive. But when Sukkot comes and they leave their homes and come under the shadow of the Sukkah, their hearts are full of trust, faith, and joy. For now they are protected, not by the protection of their roofs, but by the shadow of their faith and trust in God. The matter may be compared to a person who locks himself up at home for fear of robbers. Regardless of how many locks he uses, and how strong these locks may be, he remains afraid lest the locks be broken. Once he hears the voice of the king approaching and calling, "Emerge from your chamber and join me," he is no longer afraid. He immediately opens his doors and emerges joyously to join the king, for wherever the king is, no harm can come to him. He then goes wherever the king leads him, and trust and joy never depart from him. In the Sukkah, a house that is open to the world, a house that freely acknowledges that it cannot be the basis of our security, we let go of this need. The illusion of protection falls away, and suddenly we are flush with our life, feeling our life, following our life, doing its dance, one step after another. And when we speak of joy here, we are not speaking of fun. Joy is a deep release of the soul, and it includes death and pain. Joy is any feeling fully felt, any experience we give our whole being to. We are conditioned to choose pleasure and to reject pain, but the truth is, any moment of our life fully inhabited, any feeling fully felt, any immersion in the full depth of life can be the source of deep joy. Such is the testimony of Heschel, one of the elderly Jews of Venice, California, whose wisdom is collected in Barbara Meyerhoff's Number Our Days. "So I'll tell you how I survive, but you won't like it. Every time I say anything about it, people shudder, but you couldn't get away from it, the thing I am talking about. The word is pain. Pain is the avenue to getting a soul, getting quality from yourself. Now, if you would like to hear a little more, I could give you an example. When I start to talk about pain, it leaves me. That's why I don't like to talk so much. All that I got to say is painful, and when I tell somebody about it, then I feel better. But that's no good. It comes back to you when you're not looking. Whoosh, it jumps out from behind the stove and grabs you. So when the pain comes, I am patient. I shut up. Active silence. I bear it, wait, even overnight. But I mean I bear it. I don't take a tranquilizer, a sleeping pill, some schnapps, or watch television. I stand before it. I call the pain out. After you go through this, you discover you got choices. You become whole. This is the task of our life. I want to live this kind of life so I can be alive every minute. I want to know when I'm awake, I'm altogether awake. When I'm asleep, I'm asleep." But few of us could bear to be this awake to our lives. As laudable as this relationship to our experience may be, we will likely find the experience of being flush with reality every single second of our lives to be unbearable, untenable, and otherwise impossible. In Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade tells the story of his first case as a private detective. He was called in by a woman to trace the whereabouts of her husband, who had suddenly gone missing. This man had been one of Seattle's leading insurance salesmen. He and his wife had lived in a beautiful house and were well respected in the Seattle community. Then one day he disappeared without a trace. Sam Spade tracked this man doggedly for years. Finally, he found him in Tacoma, a half-hour's drive from Seattle. Now he was one of Tacoma's leading real estate salesmen. He was married again, and he and his new wife lived in a beautiful house and were pillars of Tacoma society. Spade was mystified. This man seemed to have stepped out of one life and then replicated it precisely less than half an hour's drive away. Why had he done it? One day at lunchtime, the man explained, he had been walking back to his office in downtown Seattle when a brick fell out of the window of a tall building and came so close to him that it actually grazed his face. This man was thunderstruck. He had very carefully constructed a life that in no way took account of the possibility of a brick falling from a window and killing him. So he left that life straight away. He hitchhiked to the coast, caught a tramp steamer bound for the South Pacific, and sailed around the world several times. He had adventures in all the great cities of the world. Then, little by little, without even realizing what he was doing, he drifted back to the States, settled in Tacoma, became enormously successful again, married another lovely wife, and built another beautiful house. Sam Spade gave this story the following moral. He adjusted his life to take into account that bricks fell out of windows, but then bricks stopped falling out of windows. In other words, we cannot bear too much reality. Form, the Buddhists remind us, is emptiness. Yesh, beingness, the Jewish mystics insist, is ayin, nothingness. But emptiness is also form. Ayin is also yesh. The forms from which we derive comfort and security may well be an illusion, and may well be a shell that stands between us and our experience, but they are an inescapable illusion, an inevitable shell. Form is an inevitable part of our spiritual landscape. We can't live apart from it. But once a year, after several months of reconnecting with the emptiness at the core of form, we leave the formal world behind. We sit in a house that is only the idea of a house that calls attention to the illusory nature of all houses. And there is a joy in this, a joy born of the realization that nothing can protect us, nothing can save us from death, so it's no use defending ourselves. We may as well give up, and there is a wonderful release in this giving up. I feel this joy as I sit in the sukkah, drinking soup cooled by the rain. Tomorrow morning I will wave the lulav and the etrog, the four species we are commanded to take up during Sukkot. In my right hand I will hold the long spine of a palm branch with two willow sprigs tied to its left and three sprigs of myrtle to its right. And in my left hand I will hold a yellow citron full of pox and ridges, and I will wave these things twice, once as I sing hymns of joy and praise to God, and once as I march around the synagogue in solemn procession crying, "Save me, please, save me, please." The sexual imagery couldn't be clearer. The palm frond phallus with the myrtle and willow testes, the ridged and speckled yellow fruit, nor could it be more appropriate. What sex and agriculture have in common is that they point simultaneously to both the power and the impotence of the human condition. We have no idea how to form a human life. We can't make it happen by ourselves, yet we are absolutely indispensable to the process. We have no idea how a seed bears fruit. We can't make that happen either, yet if we don't plant the seed and nurture it and water it and harvest it, no fruit will ever come. These things can't happen without us. But neither can we make them happen on our own. So tomorrow morning I will walk around the synagogue celebrating both our power and our impotence, our miraculous capacity to bear and nurture life, and our utter dependence on God for it. And I will feel a deep sense of joy as I do, because this is the truth of my life. This is the cusp I actually stand on at every moment of my life. Every moment of my life, I am utterly powerless and infinitely powerful. Every moment of my life, I am inescapably hammered into place by everything that has ever happened since the creation of the universe. And every moment, I am free to act in a way that will alter the course of that great flow of being forever. and here at the core of our life, here at its paradoxical center, there is a mysterious, inexplicable, senseless joy. The poet Gerald Stern captures this joy quite precisely in the poem Lucky Life. Dear waves, what will you do for me this year? Will you drown out my scream? Will you let me rise through the fog? Will you fill me with that old salt feeling? Will you let me take my long steps in the cold sand? Will you let me lie on the white bedspread and study the black clouds with the blue holes in them? Will you let me see the rusty trees and the old monoplanes one more year? Will you still let me draw my sacred figures and move the kites and the birds around with my dark mind? Lucky life is like this. Lucky there is an ocean to come to. Lucky you can judge yourself in this water. Lucky you can be purified over and over again. Lucky there is the same cleanliness for everyone. Lucky life is like that. Lucky life, oh lucky life, oh lucky, lucky life, lucky life. This is the overwhelming, senseless gratitude we feel when we are finally, fully awake. And it makes no difference what we awaken to, whether it is to pain or to pleasure, to life or to death. It is all of a piece, all the ground of a deep joy when fully inhabited, when wholly attended to. Nor does it make any difference that we will inevitably sleep again, that we will drift back into our house or one remarkably like it without even realizing that we have. It makes no difference that there will once again be walls between us and the rest of the world. In the fullness of time, these walls will also fall down, and a great horn will sound, calling us to wakefulness again. This has been a Hachette audio production of This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared, The Days of Awe as a Journey of Transformation. Written by Alan Liu. Read by Alan Robertson. Produced by Greg Cooler. Directed by Adam Garner. Recorded by Dante Hodge. Post-production by Listen Up Audiobooks. This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2003 by Alan Liu. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.